Good morning to you, and a good Friday, too. I'm Veronica Rickert, in today for Kathleen Dunn, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. In China, 59% of undergrads get degrees in science and engineering. In Japan, 66% do. That number in the U.S., only 32%. In Singapore, 44% of students scored at the most advanced level in mathematics. In the U.S., 7%. They're scary statistics and may be evidence of a looming crisis in the ability of the U.S. to compete in the world marketplace. Our guest this hour thinks we can turn things around with a little help from computer games. He says instead of being time wasters that steal from reading, writing, and math, computer games have tremendous potential to teach kids to think like innovators, to role-play complex career choices, and learn new skill sets. What do you think? Do you see your kids learning new stuff faster and better with the help of computer games, or do you try to keep them away from too much online or computer gaming? And are you worried about the next generation competing in the global marketplace? And what games have your kids played? Hope you'll join us this hour and join in our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Our guest this hour is David Williamson Schaefer. He's Associate Professor of Learning Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Game Scientist at the Academic Advanced Distributed Learning Co-Laboratory. He's the author of How Computer Games Help Children Learn. And David Williamson Schaefer, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning to you. And I want to ask you, do you see a crisis looming in the way we prepare kids to enter the global marketplace?
Yes. Yeah, I do. You know, we're essentially trying to use 18th century schools to prepare kids for the 21st century. And instead, what we need to be doing is using the same technologies that are creating a digital revolution to prepare kids for the world that revolution is making.
And computer games are a big part of this.
Well, yeah, they are. You know, what we're doing right now in schools is especially with No Child Left Behind, is we're doing more and more to teach basic facts and basic skills so kids can pass standardized tests.
You call it drill and skill.
Yeah, and people sometimes call it drill and kill, actually. and, you know, the problem is that by definition, a standardized skill is something that can be done either by a computer or by somebody else with a computer anywhere in the world. What we need is to be training kids to think in innovative and creative ways, to use computers to solve problems, to do things that can't be done by a computer alone or can't be done anywhere else in the world.
And you think that by necessity this can only be done with computers because computers are going to be so entangled with the world as we know it, as it evolves. What is going on in schools that we are not getting the computer skills that you're talking about?
Well, part of it is we just have the wrong orientation. I want to just say at the outset that, you know, there are all kinds of problems that our schools have and that our infrastructure has more generally. But, you know, broadly speaking, teachers are some of the most dedicated, hardworking, underpaid people that I know. The problem is that we're asking teachers and kids to focus on the wrong things. We have a set of tests that measure the wrong set of outcomes, and we have a system that's essentially 100 years old or 150 years old and hasn't been changed to adapt to the new reality.
Well, we talked about some of those statistics in the beginning, 66% going into science and math in China, for instance. What are other countries doing to be so competitive that we are not doing here?
Well, I get this question a lot. And sure, partly it's true that there are other countries that are either doing a better job or trying to do a better job of using digital technologies. But you also have to keep in mind that the numbers are against us in the sense that, China has the world's largest population. They have the world's largest population of poor people. But the middle class population of China is larger than the entire population of the United States. You know, the joke goes in China, when you're one in a million, there are 1,000 people just like you. And so in a sense, the 7% of people who are doing well in mathematics here, even if China is only still producing 7% of people who are doing well, there's a much larger number of people who are going to be competing for the high end jobs. In addition, you know, there are different countries and different cultures emphasize different things as being important career goals for kids. And I think we can do a better job here of focusing kids on innovative and creative thinking, on technology. You know, rather than demonizing technology, we should we could do a better job of embracing it and preparing them and motivating them for the kinds of careers they need to be looking towards in the future.
We were talking about the schools, and my mother is a teacher, and I hang out in her classroom a fair amount. And it's interesting. She's got, I think, 16 to 20 kids. I'm not sure how many exactly, but they've only got one or two computers in the room, and they're kind of dinosaurs. They're not cutting edge, and you can imagine that if you wanted to teach kids and get them really comfortable on the computer and really integrate that into the curriculum, you're not going to do it with two computers.
No, you're not. I volunteer in classrooms here in Madison. Both my daughters are in the public schools. And that's absolutely true. There are two computers. And, you know, what happens is old computers come to the high school. Then the computers that were already old in the high school get passed to the middle school. And the computers that were even older in the middle school get passed down and so on all the way until they reach the kindergarten class. So much so that the teacher can actually barely fill out the online reports that she has to fill out because this computer is so slow. It's sort of the equivalent of asking our kids to learn to read and write by giving them quill pens on the theory that, you know, the good pens should go to the kids in high school and then their old used pens and pencils would go to middle school and so on until essentially you'd get the dregs, the little nubs of pencils when you were in kindergarten to work with.
Well, essentially, we're talking about, I'm sure this is not ideal by the standards of the educators, the teachers, or anybody in the system, but we're talking about funding problems. What can we do to sort of surmount those issues?
Well, you know, as I say in How Computer Games Help Children Learn, what can be done is a technological question. What should be done is a pedagogical question. What will be done is a political question, and that's above my pay grade, as they say sometimes. I'm not a policymaker, but one of the things that I would like to emphasize, and I talk about this in the book as well, is that anybody who's looking at computers as a way to solve our educational problems and to do it for less money is probably misguided, right? There is some research that suggests that simply spending more money on schools doesn't provide better quality education. And that's almost certainly true because just spending more money doesn't solve problems unless you're spending money on the right things. So we clearly have to invest more in our educational system. And we have to do more to invest in the right things. And certainly technology and the training that teachers need to use it and the development of games and simulations and other tools that kids need to use that are going to be cutting edge and are going to prepare them for the digital future. These are all ways in which we need to invest much more heavily in our future. And you know, the bottom line is that ultimately the kids today in school are going to be paying for your retirement and my retirement and probably for the retirement of most of the people who are listening on the program. So it's a pretty good investment, I think, because if they can't find good jobs, then all of us are in for a world of trouble.
Well, let's get specific. Let's talk about the types of games that you're talking about. Can you give me an example of one or two games that sort of epitomize what you're talking about, a game that can help kids learn, that teaches innovative thinking, and how you've seen it employed?
Sure. So listeners here in Madison or in the Madison area know that this past summer, we actually had kids playing a game called Urban Science. We were working with the outreach program here at the University of Wisconsin, and there were middle school kids from Madison and the surrounding communities who were coming to the campus for 4 weeks. They came 4 hours every morning, giving up their summer to play this game. And in the game, they become urban planners. They work for a fictitious urban planning firm called Urban Design Associates, and they were essentially redesigning Madison to address the issues in the community and plan for sustainable growth for the future. As part of the company, they took on three different projects looking at State Street, the Shank Atwood neighborhood, and the north side of Madison where the fringe growth in the city is taking place. In each of these projects, they actually went and visited the neighborhoods. They talked online with virtual stakeholders, non-player characters in the game who represented the various interest groups in the city, environmental groups, the Chamber of Commerce, parent and teacher organizations, and so on. They took all of that information and sat down with a geographic information systems model, the same kind of software that urban planners use here at the university, to look at how the things that people cared about, housing and tax revenue and property values and jobs and waste and traffic and so forth, how different land use choices affected those things. What happens, for example, if you take the Overture Center and turn it into a parking lot? Well, not surprisingly, the amount of parking on State Street goes up, but people are pretty unhappy because the cultural life of the city goes down. And so they looked at how all of these factors are interrelated using this software, and they prepare something that real urban planners use called preference surveys, which are possible plans for the city. Not proposals, but ideas that they can show to the stakeholders in the game and see what their reaction is. And they use these preference surveys to gauge how important different issues are to different constituencies and then take all that information and propose a comprehensive redesign plan for Madison. And in fact, in the game this summer, we were fortunate. Mayor Dave came, the mayor of Madison came, and saw the presentations and was actually asking for advice from these young planners about how to not only to solve the problems that they were looking at in the game, but some other problems that Madison faces. And, you know, what our studies show is that when kids are playing urban science and other games like it, they're not just getting better at playing the game. They're getting better at thinking about the complex issues of economics and social issues and cultural issues and environmental issues that face a city, and they have a much richer set of tools for learning how to think about those in innovative and creative ways.
So you're really talking about a really rich, multi-layered game, and it almost doesn't deserve the name computer game because you went out into the community. You had so many facets of this that it seems as though the computers were maybe layer one of it. When most people hear computer games, they don't think about the game you just described. They're thinking about, I don't know, maybe not Mortal Kombat or Guitar Hero, but something that's a little more game.
Well, you mean if by that you mean a little more time is spent on the computer screen,
more entertainment, less education.
Well, I think that we have the sad tendency to believe that those two things are in opposition. That is, it's either entertaining or it's educational. And that's just not necessarily true. Just let me give you another quick example. Because the games that we develop are deliberately very high-end games. What we're trying to do is explicitly see if you set up the best possible conditions, what could you do with game technology? But there are commercial games out there that are similarly complex. One of the games I talk about in How Computer Games Help Children Learn is the game The Political Machine. In The Political Machine, you're running a presidential campaign. You're the campaign manager. You get to choose where you want to set up campaign headquarters, where you want the candidate to visit, whether you want the candidate to give speeches or not, what the topics of the speeches should be, when you're going to do fundraising, what you want to take out as media buys, television, radio, newspapers, in what markets, what you want the ads to say. You have to manage the campaign budget. The game is updated with real-world information, both about state-by-state voting trends on real issues and also fundraising and other economic data. The issues are things like the war in Iraq, the war on terror, Social Security, and the current issues of the day, which, again, are continuously updated
online.
What
is the age level for that game?
Well, my daughter enjoyed playing that game with me when she was in kindergarten.
No kidding.
And I enjoyed playing it on my own. And in fact, I was traveling overseas, and a friend of mine who has a master's in government from the Kennedy School at Harvard was interested in the work I do, and I said, "Well, here's a game you could play." And she basically spent 4 hours straight playing it. So it has a broad appeal. That game is played entirely on the computer, but it's pretty clear that in order to play it, you have to learn a lot about the Electoral College and what the current issues of the day. Why is it that people campaign in some states and not others? There's no point in campaigning as a Democrat in states that are never going to vote for you, and so on. So these kinds of rich worlds that games create can be created mostly on the screen. In the case of urban science, it's on the screen, but also out in the real world. And so what's important to remember about computers is what they let us do is build simulations. Now, these can be simulations of things that are too difficult or expensive or dangerous to do in the real world. The power of a game is that it lets somebody live in one of these simulated worlds. Now, we can build simulated worlds of adventure and excitement. We can build simulated worlds of violence, and we almost certainly do too much of that today, if you ask me. But we can also build simulated worlds where young people have an opportunity to take on real problems and learn to think about them in innovative and creative ways. And that's the real power of computer games for education in a global economy and in a digital age.
We are talking this hour with David Williamson Schaefer. He's the Associate Professor of Learning Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and game scientist at the Academic Advanced Distributed Learning Co-Laboratory. He's the author of How Computer Games Help Children Learn. What do you think? Have you noticed when your kids are playing some of the types of games that David Schaefer is talking about that they do learn quicker, they do learn better, and maybe the depth of their learning goes deeper? And what games do you think your kids like? And are there games you think are maybe questionable in terms of their value? Would you like to see more of this in the schools? Call us and join in the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. We'd love to hear from you. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. At 12:30 on Chapter a Day, Jim Fleming reads from American Creation, Triumphs and Tragedies at the Founding of the Republic by Joseph J. Ellis. Veronica Rickert, back with you. I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, and we're talking with David Williamson Schaefer, who is Associate Professor of Learning at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and Game Scientist at the Academic Advanced Distributed Learning Co-Laboratory. He's the author of How Computer Games Help Children Learn. And David Williamson Schaefer, you were talking about a fascinating-sounding political game. What was it called again?
The Political Machine.
The Political Machine. And you played that with your daughter when she was in kindergarten.
Yes.
Do you think if that game, if it weren't a game, if she were sitting down trying to absorb information the way that kids traditionally have done in schools, which is to open a book, to read about it, maybe to see a little slideshow, would she have been able to do all that?
Well, no. Nor would she, I think, have been able to just sit down with the Political Machine, the game, on her own and play. It was really important that I was playing with her, and that's one of the biggest things that I talk about in How Computer Games Help Children Learn, is that it's important to play games with kids as parents and as teachers. But the thing that games do is they make it possible to do things that are more complex than you could do on your own. And what that means is that you can start with a very complex world and only go as deep into it as you're able to go, but still be able to see the big picture. You know, our schools are built just the opposite way. That is, you have to start by mastering all the little basics, all the little pieces, and only later, often much later, 10 or 20 or 30 years later, do you put them all together and see how they work. And so does my daughter understand the details of the game as richly as I do? No, but she's still able to play it and able to take from it what she can at her level of sophistication.
And you say in your book that it may be that, according to some studies, we're really never able to assimilate all of the, well, to apply all of the information that we've learned in schools in a comprehensive way, that we've got, what we end up with is sort of a ragtag bunch of facts and figures and knowledge that doesn't really fit into a cohesive way to function in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I sometimes talk about schools as the bricks and mortar theory of education, that what we do is we give kids a bunch of bricks, and then we test them to see that they have the bricks. We say, show me the blue brick. Show me the red brick. Show me the square one. Show me the big one. Which brick is bigger than the other? That's essentially the structure of our standardized tests. And the theory is that they'll take these bricks and they'll carry them around with them for 10 or 20 years. And when they finally need to use them, they'll have the bricks there. Well, the problem is that 50 years worth of research in cognitive science suggests that if you give kids a bunch of bricks, they do just about what you'd expect. The bricks are heavy. They don't really like carrying them around. They don't see any use for them. And so they leave them lying here and there. And then when they come to need them, they don't actually have them.
Hmm.
Whereas if you show them how to build a model of something out of Lego bricks, right? It's what they're getting is a picture of the whole and how all the pieces fit together, even in a simplified way. And then later on, when they want to build something, they have a model of the big picture. And they can go and find many of the bricks that they need because they have the skills to go out and get information and to assimilate it well.
You mentioned cognitive science. Is there any evidence that these computer games that you're describing do up the absorption of the way kids learn and change the way they think, maybe change the way that the brain processes information?
We're just starting to get data of that kind. Part of the challenge, though, is that many of the measures that we use to decide whether or not somebody knows something are measures that are based on basic facts and basic skills. The point of the game isn't that it's producing kids who know more basic facts and basic skills. Sometimes they do, and often they know a lot of basic facts and basic skills. But, you know, if I wanted to get somebody to pass a standardized test, the most efficient thing to do is just to drill them on the questions for the standardized test. The problem is that's a very poor thing to do if what I want them to be able to do later is remember and use the information or the
ideas. So in other words, it's hard to measure creativity.
Well, it's hard to measure creativity with the tools that we have now. And one of the things that we're doing in our research, for example, is starting to come up with ways of measuring what it is that kids are getting when they really learn to think like in innovative and creative ways. I mean, one of the things that I think is worth keeping in mind is that we actually know a lot about innovation and creativity. And we know it because we can look around us and see people in the world who solve problems that don't have standardized answers and do that day in and day out. We call those people, for the most part, professionals. People like doctors and lawyers and architects and engineers and urban planners and journalists, people for whom problems aren't the same and can't be solved with a standardized answer. That's why we give them autonomy to exercise their professional judgment. And we know a lot about how people learn to think in those ways. I mean, they learn to do it typically through a professional practicum. And a professional practicum is, you can think of like a architecture studio for architects, internship and residency for doctors, moot court for lawyers, capstone courses in engineering and journalism. These are places where professionals in training have a chance to solve real problems, but then most importantly, step back and talk about what they've done. They talk with their peers and with their mentors, and they reflect on what worked and what didn't work and why. That's what turns solving real problems into understanding how to think in innovative ways. And a game like Urban Science and the other games that we developed, Digital Zoo, where kids learn to be engineers, Science.net, where they learn to be journalists, these are games that recreate that same process of taking action and then reflecting on that action to build understanding of innovation and creativity.
Well, the doctors and lawyers you talked about do their reflection in a community. And I think one of the fears about computer games is that you're going to have a lot of kids sitting alone in front of the computer. And even if you've got a vast network of people, maybe even around the world, like in World of Warcraft, you're still talking about 2 million people sitting alone in front of their computers. Well, where does the community come in?
Well, that is a concern. And, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that I have a very large community and a family that I stay in touch with, but I don't actually see them face-to-face that much. Much of my family lives back on the East Coast, and I sit alone and talk to them on the telephone. Increasingly, I sit alone and either type email to them or I instant message with them. So community doesn't necessarily have to be that you're sitting face-to-face. There is, however, some interesting data. It's relatively preliminary and relatively new, but that suggests that I'm basing this on a study by Joe Kahn from Mills College in California. And some of that data suggests that if kids play on their own PlayStation or computer or play a computer game on something that they own, they actually spend a larger percentage of their time playing with other people than if they're playing somewhere else and not on their own machine. I mean, there's a lot of research that suggests that games are very social. They're things that kids either play with each other because the other kids are there, or it's something that they talk about after they've played. In the same way that we play sports or watch television and then talk about them at work, it's something that they do at school. They debate and discuss. They go and try things based on the conversations that they've had. So people are worried that computers are a very solitary endeavor, and for the most part, that's not the way kids play them.
All right, we've got a lot of folks waiting to talk to you, so let's go ahead and take some calls. Here's one from Walter calling from Fitchburg. Hey, Walter, you're on the air.
Oh, thanks so much. Boy, it's a really interesting really interesting topic. I'm going to just cover a couple of points. On your communication issue, 40 years ago, my wife and I were freshmen in college. We would call our parents at home perhaps as often as once a week. Then we'd exchange letters. Now people are in constant communication using these, you know, the various new communication devices. So I think the isolation aspect is probably overblown. I think also just another point that you really haven't talked about yet. I don't know much about video games, but I watch our children play them, and there's a thing called DDR, Dance Dance Revolution, I think is what it's called, and the kids actually have to get up and move around on a. Like a tic-tac-toe board, and it's really pretty vigorous exercise. So it's not like you're just sitting there. I think you're seeing more and more of those games developed. The final thing I'd like to point out is there's a bill pending in the Wisconsin legislature that attempts to draw a connection between juvenile delinquency and video games. and it would impose a special sales tax on games and video game devices. And I just think that's a really nutty idea. It's probably not going to be enacted, but it is out there.
Interesting. Well, thanks for the call, Walter.
Thank you.
And David Williamson Schaefer, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, there's a couple of great points that you made there, Walter. I mean, one of them is that there are now increasingly games that are much more active than people otherwise imagine. The Wii is kind of the flagship in this. That's a product by Nintendo that you control with a wand that you wave about in the air. And so you can play golf by actually doing a golf swing, and you can bowl by swinging your arm as if you had a bowling ball in it. You can play tennis. When my father, who's in his 70s, was visiting last, I showed him the Wii tennis, and he spent two straight days playing it. And you are moving about. In fact, there are some physical therapists that I know who have recommended Wii tennis for their clients because it's a good way to get range of motion without having any without risking injury. There's no stress as you're swinging, but you're getting range of motion. There's some schools that have been using Dance Dance Revolution, which is a game where there's a mat on the floor and you have to actually enact dance moves. You work up a pretty good sweat playing it, I must say. And there are schools that are using it in gym class, for example. There are lots of ways in which the stereotype of, you know, I mean, let's face it, everybody's stereotype of a gamer is it's a poorly complected adolescent who's sitting alone in their basement on the couch playing games, eating Doritos, and drinking lots of Coca-Cola for hours on end. And the data suggests that, although certainly there are some kids who do that, that's not the average profile of the gamers. People play games at all ages. In fact, the largest single group of game players is women, middle-aged women. And there are people who play all different kinds of games. You know, Walter's point about the bill pending in the Wisconsin legislature is really well taken. And there are similar bills other places as well, I believe. And, you know, it is, of course, true that there are bad games out there. There are games that are just not that much fun. And there are games that are probably too violent. And there are games that are great games and a lot of fun, but that are terrible games for kids. Just as there are great books that I wouldn't read to my six-year-old. And so it's important to recognize that what matters in the end is choosing good games, and not only choosing good games, but playing them well, and how computer games help children learn. That's one of the points that I make over and over again. And the purpose of the book is really to be talking about what makes a game a good game and how do you play it well to get the kinds of outcomes that we care about for kids.
Well, we want to get back to the calls, but what does make a good game? How do you evaluate if you're a parent and you want to enrich your kid's life and not kill their brain?
Right. Well, there is information online to be found, not as much as one might like. And certainly there are reviews that you can read about what the game is like. You know, I think one of the best things to do as parents is to play the games and play them so you get to know what the games are like and play them so that you can evaluate them for yourself.
Well, tell us some of your favorites. What would you recommend? What are you playing? What are your kids playing?
Sure. Well, my kids' favorite game probably of all time is the game Zoo Tycoon. It's a game, again, that I talk about and how computer games help children learn. In Zoo Tycoon, you get to build and run a zoo. You decide what animals you want to have in the zoo and how you want to lay out the cages, how you want to landscape the zoo, what you're going to feed the animals, where you're going to put the food and water so people will be able to see them. You hire and fire zoo staff. You have to be responsible for their training. You get to decide what you want to have for concession stands and gift shops, what you want to offer, how much you want to charge. You have responsible for making sure the zoo is clean and so forth. And so it's a very complex game, and you get a lot of fun.
Is it fun for you too, or is this a kid's game?
No. This is a game that people can play at lots of different ages. And more important, you know, it's a game that's fun for me to play with my daughter. But one of the things that I would say that I try and emphasize to parents is that, you know, it's a good thing to play these games, and especially to play them with your kids, whether or not it's necessarily a game that you think is fun. I mean, in the same way that I go to an awful lot of soccer games and an awful lot of violin recitals, and I'm not doing it because it's great world-class soccer and that it's the best music that I've ever heard. I do it because it's a way to connect with my kids and to be a part of their lives and to play with them so that I can do the other important part of playing games well, which is to help them play reflectively, to ask them questions, to talk with them about what they're doing and why. That's what turns play in the game into understanding for the real world. And so as a parent, what you want to do is choose games that are about things that seem like they're meaningful and valuable. And you want to play the games with your kid and encourage them to play them reflectively, to ask questions that are, you know, the kinds of questions that are going to turn the play into understanding. And I talk more about, you know, what some of those things are and how computer games help children learn.
Well, you've got Zoo Tycoon. Give us a couple more real quick.
Sure. So a game that a colleague of mine actually studied here at UW studies quite extensively, Kurt Squire, studies the game Civilization. The game Civilization, you essentially build and run a civilization from the earliest time in a small village to global domination, if that's what you choose. The game SimCity is a fantastic game, one of the sort of the mother of all strategy games. You build and run a little online city. So there are a number of other games. There's a game, again, that I talk about in how computer games help children learn. There's a game Roller Coaster Tycoon, which has a water park extension. So for people who like to go to the Wisconsin Dells, you can come back and then design your own water park. I have to say that maybe is a – that game is a not – maybe not as good as Zoo Tycoon. But, you know, it depends a lot on your personal taste. And frankly, it depends a lot on the interface. You know, some games are really good ideas and they just don't play well. And you can find that out from reviews, or you can find it out by trying and seeing that it's a game that you don't particularly like. Another one of my daughter's favorite games is Karaoke Revolution. So you're a karaoke singer and you sing along with the songs and you get graded for how well you sing. And, you know, they sometimes get booed off the stage, which is a little traumatic for the five-year-old. But but on the other hand, you know, they clearly are learning to hold pitch better. And this is, you know, they take music lessons, but here's another opportunity for them to express their musical interest.
Okay, we'll go back to the phones now, and we've got Amy from Shellsburg. Hi, Amy, you're on the air.
Hi there. What a great program. Thank you. I just wanted to share an experience that I've had recently with my 13-year-old who really, really wanted STEM in a big way. And so we finally relented and got for her this program, a computer game called Sims, and I knew that they would be making, that she would be, you know, basically designing individual people. But what turned out to be a surprise bonus is that on this game she designs houses, and she has become, she wants to be an architect now. This has been about a year ago that she started building houses on Sims, and you know, was sort of a middling sort of math student and decided that really and truly she wanted to be an architect, spent the day with an architect, keep building houses on Sims, and upped her math grade to an A, subsequently decided she wants to be an engineer, and it's just been kind of a big surprise. Every day she builds a new house and prints them out or takes pictures of them, and it's just a kind of a big surprise. And the most recent addition to that is a Sims version of going into business, where now she has a retail business on a simulated, you know, Sims stuff. That's just what I wanted to share. It's really been a great learning experience for her and for me, too.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Amy. Sounds like that game has been really formative in your daughter's life. Sounds like something you might expect, David.
Well, certainly that you might hope for. That's a great example, Amy. Thanks so much for sharing it. You know, and I think that one of the things that's interesting about that example is that what you, at least as I understand it from what you were saying, Amy, is that, you know, your daughter was playing The Sims and became interested in building houses, and then her grades started to go up in school and in mathematics, although when you build a house in The Sims, there's not necessarily a lot of mathematics that you're using directly. And this is the kind of effect that we actually see a lot in this when kids play Urban Science or when they play Digital Zoo, our game about being engineers. Of course, the game gives them some information about economics or about civics or about physics in the case of the engineering game. But more than that, what happens is after the kids play the games and they go back to school, we see that they perform better in lots of different ways in school. And part of that is that they have an image of themselves as being somebody who is capable and competent, in the case of our games, a professional, somebody who uses information in meaningful ways, somebody who has something to say. One of the really interesting results is that, you know, as part of playing the games that we play that our kids play in the summer, and as part of our research, these games always involve interacting with adults, with some kind of client or somebody that you interact with as a professional. And so kids become more comfortable with public speaking. They become more comfortable talking to adults. As a result, they become more comfortable talking to their teachers. And so there's a way in which when you provide a kid with a peak experience with what psychologists call a possible self, an image of something that they might be, a positive image of what their future might look like. That resonates through lots of other things that they do and becomes a kind of positive force in their life more generally.
And I imagine it would be more non-threatening than it could be in a classroom with immediate grade, too. You're doing it for almost like the pure joy of accomplishment, not attached to any sort of particular grading level.
Well, certainly that can often be true when kids play games at home. But I think there's the potential to have many of those same kinds of effects happen in classrooms as well. I mean, we certainly have a strong association of classrooms with grades because one of the purposes of our school system is to sort kids, right? The grades aren't necessarily even used so much to help them do better. It's to show who did well and who didn't, and then therefore who deserves to go on to the next step. In games, that kind of going on to the next step actually happens in the game itself. You can't move on to the next problem until you've solved the first one. And so that sorting function is inherent in the play of the game and doesn't necessarily have to be part of the grading process in school. So I think there's a lot of potential to let kids play games in school and as a result, learn by trying things out and being willing to fail. And I guess that's one thing that we should really emphasize here is that, you know, school tells you that it's not okay to get things wrong. You're never supposed to make mistakes in school. And everything that we know as adults and everything that we know about innovation and creativity is that the way you learn is by trying something, seeing that it didn't work, and then stepping back and figuring out what to do to overcome that problem. That's the way deep learning happens.
Well, we're talking with David Williamson Schaefer, Associate Professor of Learning Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he's also a game scientist at the Academic Advanced Distributed Learning Co-Laboratory. He's the author of How Computer Games Help Children Learn. And we'll be back with more of your phone calls after we take a quick break, but there's still time for you to join in the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. And tell us about what you think about how kids interface with computer games. Do you think it's been a positive thing for your child? And what do you think you'd like to see on the horizon as far as integrating games into school curriculum? Hope to hear from you coming up. I'm Veronica Rickert, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. After 11 on Garden Talk, Larry Mueller's guest is a garden writer who's leaving a large imprint on Wisconsin gardeners. He's Mel Myers of Milwaukee, host of the PBS program Great Lakes Gardener. Veronica Rickert, I'm back with you this hour, sitting in today for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network. And we're talking video games, computer games rather, this hour with David Williamson Schaefer, who is the author of the book How Computer Games Help Children Learn. And David Williamson Schaefer, we do have more folks waiting to talk to you, so let's go ahead and take a call from Dennis in Milwaukee. Hi, Dennis, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I hope I come through. I have a little bit of a cold.
Nope, you sound fine.
All right. First of all, I wholeheartedly agree with the whole focus of your subject. But I'm coming at it from the business world. I work in the business world, and our focus is the concern that education is not producing the kinds of worker that U.S. Companies need. And our focus is that knowledge workers really need to become change-adept thinkers, and that learning to some degree is almost secondary to thinking. And I think the focus on games is actually providing the thinking skills more than the learning skills that are needed in the business world. And what my company does is really looking towards addressing the whole subject of asking the right question is more important than coming up with the right answer. So we feel if knowledge workers have the ability to ask questions in a changing situation, that's what gives them the ability to think through situations. And I'm just wondering if there's any gaming types of programs that promote abilities to think through and develop questioning skills.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call, Dennis. He's really talking about computer games changing the way that we think, which is really kind of a crux of your whole thesis here, that they change how you think, and innovative thinking is a key part of this.
Yeah. And in fact, most of the games that I've been talking about today do just what Dennis is looking for. I mean, there's some that are very obvious, a game like Science.net, which we haven't talked a lot about. But here's a game where players become science journalists, and they report about stories on science and technology that impact their community. And obviously, part of being a journalist is learning to ask questions in a situation where figuring out what the right question to ask is often the most important thing. But really, in any of these games, what you're presented with is a world, a simulated world, it's true, but a world with choices to, where choices need to be made, and information needs to be found rather than information needs to be regurgitated, if you will. Dennis makes an interesting distinction between thinking and learning, and that, you know, what we're doing now in schools is learning, and it's not learning to think. And in some ways, he's right. You know, if schools are emphasizing facts, which you can find with a Google search, and skills, which are standardized skills and are something that the computer can do instead, then, you know, we would be much better off having them play games and doing things that give them a chance to use facts and skills rather than focusing on just acquiring the facts and skills and carrying them around when something else can do that better.
It sounds like you're talking about a more flexible, almost plastic way of thinking and interacting with information. You talked about the bricks. That's a pretty static image right there. And Dennis and you, I get the sense that this is really about sort of flexibility.
Well, it's about flexibility in it. And it's also about the fact that what computers are doing is changing what it means to think and what it means to be educated. You know, our schools were developed in a time where pencil and paper were the dominant technology. And what pencil and paper do is essentially they offload, or if you prefer the business term, they outsource memory, right? So what I learned to do with a pencil and paper is to let the pencil and paper do the remembering, and I do the summarizing of information, right? What a computer does is actually does parts of thinking for us. It solves simple problems so that we can move on and solve more complex problems. I mean, just a quick example, you know, my daughter today, actually probably right about now, is in school having a spelling test. They have a spelling test every week, and the majority of her homework now in third grade is around, you know, learning her spelling words. As soon as she sits down to type in a word processor instead of writing with a pen, what she discovers is, when you type in Microsoft Word, it underlines the words that are misspelled. And not only that, it shows you a list of choices about which word you should put in its place. How much of her third grade education should we spend doing something that the computer is going to do for her as soon as she starts using it? Rather, what she needs to be doing is learning to think with the computer and solve problems that the computer alone can't solve.
I have mixed feelings about that. In terms of, you know, take the example of spelling. Isn't something being lost if we are letting the computer – I mean, obviously, we need to let the computers help. We have lots of instances where we have devices that help us. But isn't something being lost in the way that we build our education? Something as fundamental as spelling, are we going to end up with skills that maybe have gaping holes in them if we don't ever learn how to spell, for instance?
Well, I think it's a matter of trade-offs. I mean, one of the things we haven't yet talked about is the issue of balance, and I hope we'll come back to that in a couple minutes. But it's a trade-off. Sure, it's great to know how to spell. But how much time do you want to invest in knowing how to spell versus the other things you could be doing? I mean, if you look at mathematics education, we spend the first 5 years of kids' mathematical lives recreating the things that a 99-cent calculator can do for them. Now, does it mean that kids shouldn't have a sense of numbers and understand what addition is? No, of course not. Of course they need to know those things. But how much time do you spend on mastering specific algorithms for addition or for multiplication or long division, for example, when you could be spending that time doing something else that would be much more interesting? They teach cursive still in the Madison Public Schools, as you probably know. My daughter's just starting to learn cursive. And she has terrible, terrible handwriting. It's torture for her to learn cursive. And so I said to the teacher at one point, you know, well, wouldn't it be better off if she spent time typing? I mean, here she's now at the point where her inability to write clearly is getting in the way of the higher level parts of writing, organization and sentence structure and those kinds of things, because her handwriting is so bad. And the teacher said, well, it's important that they also learn to write by hand. And the reason that she gave is because on the standardized tests, you have to write by hand and can't use a computer. So here we are spending all of this curricular time training kids to answer questions, to develop skills and to learn facts for the tests, not to actually use the technologies that they're going to really use and use them in a creative and as Dennis says, critical way.
Okay, back to the phones now, and let's take a call from Sean in Madison. Hey, Sean, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. This is a great show, and Veronica, I got to say, it's always a pleasure to hear your voice.
Oh, thank you.
Running the mic. I just wanted to give a quick shout out to David's book. I read it last year when it came out in hard copy, and actually had the opportunity to do some work with it, and it sort of acted as a primer for me. I didn't know very much about computer games in a learning context at all, and immediately following reading that book, I was able to turn that into a pretty cool job working with some of the other crew at the UW doing a conference on computers, and I really think David's book was kind of a keystone in helping me grok the whole concept, and so I wanted to just recommend it. It'll be easier for everyone to get now in paperback, and congratulations on a great book, David.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for the call, Sean. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean. Yeah, I mean, one of my goals in writing this book, I'm an academic. I work here at the university. We have research papers and studies that we produce. But the real goal in this book was to talk to parents and to teachers, to adults who care about education, and to give them a way of thinking about these problems. Because ultimately, if we're going to change, if we're going to prepare kids for the 21st century, it's we adults who have to do our homework. We have to be thinking about education in a different way. I mean, Veronica, you and I were just talking about this a moment ago. You know, we have views about education that are 150 years old. We have a school system that was designed, deliberately designed in the Industrial Revolution to prepare young people for factory work, to live in an industrial economy. And the problem isn't that schools do a bad job of that. It's that that's not the world that we're preparing kids for anymore. And so in order to prepare them for the world of the future, we have to think about learning in new ways and think about how games can actually show us the way and take kids to the kind of learning that they need for a changed world. And that's really what the book is about. And, you know, it's written in a way to take these ideas and show them through vivid examples and to make them accessible and to make people see that it's not just about learning basic facts and basic skills better or quicker, or learning or making our education system cheaper, or letting kids continue their education at home. It's about a different way of thinking about what it means to be educated in a modern world.
And I get the sense that not all of the changes you're talking about are going to be comfortable. You mentioned your daughter's cursive training and the standardized test reason that the teacher gave for all the time spent on it. And it's not an easy decision. On the one hand, I see what you're saying. It's time to make room for new things. On the other hand, there is this incredible, sort of just very human lineage of putting your hand on a pen and writing something down. And it seems as though we don't want to lose touch with some of the crafts that are just sort of what make us human.
No, that's an excellent point. And, you know, one of the points that I make every time I talk about the book is that, of course, kids need balance in their education and in their upbringing. Right. It's nobody is suggesting that all they should do ever is play computer games. It's important that kids spend time out in nature. It's important that kids spend time hanging out with their friends doing nothing. It's important that they spend time reading books. It's important that they spend time doing arts and crafts. It's important that they spend time watching TV and movies and learning to do that responsibly. But it's also important that they spend time with the technologies that are going to shape the future and learn how to use those responsibly as well. And part of our job as parents and as teachers is to find the right balance for kids. And this book is about an important part of that balance.
Okay, and time for a call from Skylar in Kewaunee. Hi, Skylar, go ahead.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to bring it back around to the games again. I was actually playing a video game when the program came on, but my comment or my ideas with this, I love the idea of the learning with video games. It's very to the generation. But one thing is that as gamers or like as kids grow older, when they're young, they can have the games can be simple and it'll work with them. When they're older, though, and naturally, of course, your life is more complex as you grow older. You start developing relationships and hardships and whatnot. So the games that they play, they always like their games also to become more complex to go with their life. So I remember a question earlier about what makes a good game, and that's any number of opinions. In mine, it's something like graphics involving story and good gameplay. But with the learning, I can't wait for the day where it comes out with a very involving simulation of something. I don't know, but do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, I think so. One of the things I talk about in how computer games help children learn is the idea that the game is always more than just what comes in the box. It's all the things you do. It's all the people you talk with. It's all the things you think about, the things you care about while you're playing the game. And what that means is that we as adults have the opportunity to turn to make a game a good game. That's an essential part of what makes a game for learning. And an important concept here is the idea that what you want to be doing is choosing games that are asking you to do something that you can't quite do just by yourself, that really gets you to draw somebody else in and work with somebody who's more knowledgeable and to learn from the experience of trying something that's challenging and having somebody else be able to model for you the ways of thinking that you need to solve problems that are meaningful. And so, of course, as you get older, you need to play more and more challenging games. But part of that is finding somebody to play them with, in a sense.
Well, we're out of time for calls, but David Williamson Schaefer, what's your favorite game?
My favorite game, personally? My favorite game right now is probably still Zoo Tycoon,
actually. Zoo Tycoon. I've got to get my hands on that. That sounds pretty fun. Well, thank you so much for joining us this hour. It's been really fascinating.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for coming into the studio. I've been talking with David Williamson Schaefer. He's the author of How Computer Games Help Children Learn. And he's also Associate Professor of Learning Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I want to thank Rhonda Fanning for producing that hour and for on-air production as well. Stay tuned. Larry Mueller is coming up here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.